I'm John Lepkoski, and I've been in cyberpunk cyborg mode for almost three decades now. And I've known our next speaker since around the 1980s, around the time he and other science fiction writers created the cyberpunk literary subgenre. Probably not realizing at the time how the early mainstreaming of the internet would energize their ideas as a cultural motif. Since those days, our speaker today has surfed the bleeding edge of the intersection of technology, art, design, and experiential futurism. In all he does, in his writings, and his talk, he is a master of visionary insight. Please welcome author, journalist, world traveler, thinker, designer, and futurist, our speaker today, Bruce Sterling.
Hi there. Thanks for showing up. I warned you I would be back. That was all true. I'm Bruce Sterling, author, journalist, South by heritage item. I'm just always here. These Tuesday speeches, as John points out, been going on basically forever. They're like a ritual purgation. Normally I complain a lot in these speeches. Climate change always gets a look in. Every year I appear, I'm like, you want to know about the future? The climate's changing. And every next year I've come back and it's worse. And people show up in the audience anyway, that's never a surprise. But CO2 this year, out the roof. There will be hell to pay. So I don't know quite why you guys persistently show up here, but you know, why do I appear? Basically, I sort of take the moral temperature of the event. You know, I've kind of been here a long time, so I've got like a long record of comparison. So the event, or rather the industry, as I think we can properly call it now, the industry shows up, and South by Interactive, personally special to me, although I can see that it's become a technology trade show, and I'm okay with that. There are many such shows. It's like going to the big fancy furniture show in Milan, where they know how to do things like that, and I go, and it's always interesting. And it's kind of like going to a really big construction show where they show off the specialized plumbing fixtures and the aluminum siding. And I do go to shows like that. They don't have to be bleeding edge or science fictional to maintain my interest. I actually enjoy older technologies, too. I've gotten to the age where they don't have to be glamorous and freaky for me. I'm like willing to bridge the gap there. So what's been hopping 2017 at this rather glum, rainy, and gloomy South by? Pretty day today, but it was creepy earlier. Not only was the weather pretty bad, but pretty clearly the people at South by are coming to realize they're just not the official future right now. The new darling American industries are oil companies and military industrial contractors. They're getting their day in the sun again. They're guys who've already seen plenty of industry consolidation. And I see consolidation in the digital industries, too. They still talk a good game of, you know, wild digital revolution. But I've seen those, and that's not what's going on in 2017. I don't want to hurt your feelings unnecessarily. But let's be frank here. I mean, what do people at South by think is worthy of their attention? Well, we've got the handy list from the awards ceremony, so I'm just going to spool through those as a South by veteran. Am I, like, amazed, shocked, awed by these fantastic tech developments, or are they pretty much digital business as usual? Okay, health, med, and biotech. Everybody else in the world thinks American healthcare is awful. Connecting people, all right, that interests me. I'm especially interested in like weird little Internet of Things protocols, Li-Fi, I like that a lot. Personally, I have enough connectivity to people. I've found I don't need any more. I'm kind of maxed out on it. I mean, authors are supposed to really like being famous, kind of publicly available, you know, but connectivity is not the same thing as literary fame. The most famous authors are dead authors. So for a living author, it's more like too much networking means actually not working. And I see that as a problem. I realize there's a lot of good work still to be done in connecting people to people, but it's become something like working on the highway system or stringing power wires. It's basically infrastructure work. Okay, there's an award for innovative 3D do-it-yourself. I'm exceedingly keen on this, totally into it. I could tell you it's not going to turn the world on its ear. I mean, contemporary social media DIY, it's basically popular mechanics with digital characteristics. It's got deep roots in society. There's always people who are going to like it. It's not a revolution. We have built a maker house in Italy. It's got a lot of this innovative open source 3D furniture in it. I'm quite intimate with it. I really wanted to experience it. We did it for 2 years. People like the little house a lot, mostly because it's fun and it looks different. Not because it's like an explosive house of, you know, futuristic detonations in there. In terms of actual daily life, when you live with homemade digital furniture, it's mostly about living on unvarnished plywood. Or, you know, 3D printed plastic connectors. I wanted to see what that looked like if you made an attempt to like domestically normalize it. I was at it for over 2 years. Now I know what it looks like. Most people who visit that house think of it as an art project. It's cute, you know, it's kind of an art project. Okay, there's an award for music and audio innovation. All right, musicians suffer terribly. Whatever happens to musicians will happen to everybody else. And music, as it's played on contemporary digital hardware, sounds worse than it did on analog hardware 40 years ago. The new economy, it's terrible. It's a curse. Everyone hates and fears it. No one is optimistic about it. Even the very few guys who really made out like bandits are afraid of the new economy. Nobody's happy with it. Privacy and security, there isn't any. There isn't any. I mean, even the CIA doesn't have it. Maybe Vladimir Putin has some of it, but probably less than you would think. Responsive design. Okay, I really like design, interaction design, UX, whatever it's called this week. They've been at it for 40 years. I knew their uncles. I knew their older brothers. Okay, they're designers, so they never bore me. My tolerance for them is super high. I really like them. They're human beings. They're not angels. They're people in the design trade. Sci-fi no longer. Okay, why is there an award for this? Also, why didn't you pick some genre to realize it was more upbeat than cyberpunk and teen dystopias? There were lots of other smart cities. I like them. I tend to live in them. If you're really a smart city, you get rid of Uber first thing. You just throw them out on their ear, and then everybody else who thinks they're smart imagines that you're crazy. They don't get it yet. Maybe someday. Okay, student innovation. I love students. I can't look at students without thinking of them as being crushed by their debt. It's really unconscionable. It hurts my morale to look at them. I feel pity for them and would love to support them. Okay, visual media experience. This is my favorite part of the show, actually. I'm totally liking the new South by Southwest installations. I saw practically all of them. They're pretty good. They were picked out tastefully. I've seen tons of these in Europe. I'm like in the curatorial business there, more or less. The ones here were great. You need more of those. I mean, if you're going to be as rich as the Medici, it's great if you're also a patron of cool Renaissance art. You can't go wrong there. You need lots more of that. Pour in the money, right? Those were pretty good. Do more. Okay, VR and AR, virtual reality, augmented reality. I totally adore these. Decades on end, mostly because I really like messing with reality. And if you're a science fiction writer, you don't like augmented reality, there's something wrong with you, in my opinion. So I'm a huge fan of augmenting reality, but just because it's really, really cool and interesting doesn't necessarily make it important. It might not even be an industry. It could be huge, like science fiction games or science fiction cinema or science fiction television, or it could be more like science fiction novels. You know, which are like kind of cool and brainy, but mostly just hang out in the corners of society covered with spider webs. Wearable tech, kind of into that. Had one go broke on my wrist this year. It's a dead pebble, got taken over. That was interesting. I mean, what happened to Pebble was more interesting than Pebble itself, in my opinion. People don't know what wearables are good for. They're mostly good as conversation pieces, actually. I mean, discussing what happened to my Pebble is, like, really interesting to people. And much more than anything my Pebble actually does, except for a few little toys that seven-year-olds really like. But, yeah, just, you know, discussing wearables is more interesting than wearables have become. So, what next? Okay, people talked about the Donald a lot. And last year I was here talking about the Donald. I said, you know, you might elect the Donald. It could happen. All right, it happened. You can go back at the speech. I have very little to add to what I was forecasting a year ago. He is like Berlusconi, just like I said. You know, the Berlusconi number one persuasive technique is what the Italians call the mud bath. You know, the mud bath is, okay, look, I know I'm talking a lot of bullshit and I'm kind of looking after my cronies here, but, you know, you're just like me. I mean, you're no better than me. This is the way it is. You know, that's the mire of politics and we're all covered with it. And so don't get on your high horse. Let's just all be kind of pals about it. And, you know, that's going to be the Donald's number one approach. He's not as catastrophic as people think. The people who voted for him, they like him. He's doing very standard red state things. He's doing things the American right has been promising or threatening to do for decades on end. I suspect, like I said last year, that if he comes a cropper, it'll probably be sex scandals. It'll be women and sex scandals, and they might be his own because he's separated from his wife now, which is a danger sign for the Donald because he doesn't take neglect easily. But mostly it's the palace intrigue around him. It's the people who surround the Donald. Although he's charismatic and kind of likable, he doesn't have any friends because he's a con man and rips off all the people who know him best. So the people around him are going to be engaged in a lot of weird palace intrigue. And plus, they're very seamy people, especially the women around him are quite peculiar. The people around the Donald are worse than him. I can say that it tires me to hear America say, this is not our America because Donald is president. That's silly, all right? I mean, nobody outside America has that attitude. Of course they know that this is the president of the United States. He's a rich TV star, con artist who mostly talks self-serving bullshit. And that's very, very American. It's super authentic. Russians, Germans, French, Norwegians, South Africans, Brazilians, none of them have a moment's illusion about it. Just I'd say, oh, that's not us, okay. They're just like, come on. He's actually better than a lot of the competition for the job of president was. I mean, people forget how bad the Donald's rivals were because now they're in a condition of Donald monomania. And even the science fiction writers of my acquaintance can't stop obsessing about him. That's not healthy. So I'm sure I'll be hearing plenty about the Donald. But I don't intend to add to the clamor myself. I mean, that's kind of taken care of. What I wonder now is, like, what should I do with my own energies, you know, given this unusual political interregnum? Well, I've also been wondering when I would find the time to write a long novel about Turin. Because I live in Turin, and I kind of like regional novels, and I never wanted to write a Texas regional novel, but the idea of writing, like, a Turinese regional novel seems kind of attractive to me, but I couldn't find the time for it because online life was so frenetic and fascinating, and I didn't know when I'd find a good excuse to put that aside without the fear of missing out on something really critically important. Well, it's pretty clear to me that the time has arrived. I can give it a year and a half. I'm almost certain that when I come back, things will be just as chaotic as they are now. I mean, there'll have been a whole lot of hay thrown in the air and all kinds of dishes shattered and bulls in china shops, but things aren't going to resolve. So, you know, I could safely devote myself to my obscure studies for this regional science fiction novel I've been planning and hoping to do for some time. And, you know, I should admit, I am a novelist. I mean, I do a lot of it. I wrote like 10, 12 of them, depending on how you count on, you know, and I'm very interested in social media and kind of like up to speed with it, but it's not literary. I mean, it's not literature. Samizdat writing, which is sort of self-published underground things, formerly very common on the internet, I found that very interesting. But viral media and clickbait, they really bore me. I mean, they're not worthy of my attention. And there's just tons of this around. And I wanted to experiment with it to sort of see what it was doing. I think the time of experimentation is over for me now. I understand the results. I mean, I should put my time at the keyboard elsewhere. And I rarely feel the urge to write a novel. I mean, I did write a dozen. It's not like I didn't have my say. But, you know, what interests me about the challenge now, if I can get a little personal, I mean, I used to write these kind of dashing, weird cyberpunk novels because I would look at some situation and just laugh. It's like, what a hilarious, weird screw-up. I mean, it like oozes black comedy from every pore. The material's great here. It's so colorful, weird, and dramatic. And, you know, it's not that I lack the energy to compose. It's more that I pity people more. Now, I've actually grown older and wiser. Old writers become worldly wise. You start reading tragic novels, you realize it's the same tragedy over and over. There are no heroes and no heroines. Everybody is engaged in a dreadful struggle, but nobody lives happily ever after. Every human institution is built on the sand of the human condition. You know, and this is a genuine literary problem. And in my advanced years, this really interests me. I think I should take time to do something serious about a mature tackling of this kind of literary problem. But I'm not going to trouble you guys further with that. I'm just promising you that it's like worth my time, and I'm not retreating from the world. I'm actually like grappling with something of interest. And I am a creative. It's a personal creative necessity. It's something I really need to do, and the time is right for it. I've just got to find a way to give it priority. You never know with a novel, but it feels like the proper thing to do now. So don't be surprised if I keep a lower profile. You don't see as much of me. I've got other things on my mind. So let's just draw two lines under all that and get on with the second half of the speech, which is more speculative in tone. I want to spend some time on a big idea that seems to be gathering some buzz here. It's one of the few things I saw at South By that seems to me to have legs and could really be a kind of future situation. It's like a not necessarily a revolutionary idea, but at least one that's very typical of our epoch. And I noticed that it now has an acronym. It's like people at South By are all using the same set of letters to describe it, which is UBI, Universal Basic Income. So, you know, when the South By team puts a little acronym on something that shows a thermometer of public acceptance, Universal Basic Income. So why has this idea become intellectually sexy in 2017? Well, it has its roots in the automation crises of the 1950s, when it was common to speculate that blue-collar labor would vanish because the factory lines were automated and everybody would be faced with awful vistas of leisure and material plenty. Well, I knew about those ideas, and that particular social fear never gets realized. I've never seen it happen. I've seen thousands of people lose their jobs, sometimes very suddenly. I have witnessed that. But the people don't just stand around, you know, with like nothing but leisure to do. They drift off diagonally into other lines of work. And I myself don't have a conventional job. I mean, I haven't had one since I was 30 years old. I mean, I basically scrounge and freelance and gig economy like a lot of other people. And, you know, I don't miss a conventional job. And a lot of people at South By who do have something like conventional jobs, I mean, they have like health insurance or have to appear at specific places at specific times, they're basically typing code or maybe even just talking aloud to bots. Now, in the days of farm labor and blue-collar industrial assembly lines, nobody would have seen typing or talking to a bot as a job at all. And coding was not even a job, you know, and bot conversation is something utterly unheard of. So, you know, people do lose job security through technical innovation, but it's not like nothing happens after that. People just pick up the way they do after a war or a famine or a hurricane, and life sort of proceeds diagonally. And that's the way it's been generally. So it may be that the entire premise of universal basic income is hokum. I mean, it's never really going to be necessary. Sure, we'll lose the jobs we have, but we'll find other ones. We'll find other things. We'll invent things to do nobody's ever heard of. You know, it'll pass without a ripple. If the people in the slums of India don't get any universal basic income, somehow they're not universal enough, then why should we also be universal? We'll just hustle and scrounge, and that'll be that. But it might be that this really is different this time, and that something genuinely new is happening, and that deep learning and new forms of robot automation are really a lot more potent than the other forms of automation. And it may be that human labor will simply fall below commodity rates for the foreseeable future. It just won't pay to have people do things that people normally do, which would be the proletariat turning into the precariat and then becoming the unnecessariat. They're just surplus flesh. We don't need them around. They're people just like us, but they serve no practical economic purpose. We just don't need them. And that might be a post-scarcity zero-work society. I mean, not only do we not need them, but we can just make all kinds of stuff for them and look after them really cheaply because we've got, like, fantastic modes of production, which is a situation that deserves some serious speculation, in my opinion. And it's like, it's a difficult thing to get your head around. Like, maybe there'd be zero work with a lot of plenty and plenty of leisure, but there might be zero work combined with tremendous scarcity. In other words, you can make things cheaply, but you just don't make a lot of it. It's just that whatever little that we have is done better with deep learners and expert systems and robots. We're really poor. Everybody gets the cheap cell phone and the cereal box, but they don't get any cereal. We get connectivity plus famine and depression. We get universal roboticized poverty. People never mentioned that. Okay, universal basic income, people have come to like the idea. It's sexy. Why is that? Well, it's a contemporary social idea that might get support from an extremely polarized left and right that really can't agree on anything and are full of spite against one another's interests. So if you're of the left, you say, well, we have no labor bargaining power. And that particular effort to organize is done for us. So instead, why don't we knock it off with the labor? I mean, they don't need us anyway. Let's live on the dole. Automatic unemployment benefits paid for by robots auto-magically. Okay, that might be a bit humiliating, but it has an upside. We'd have plenty of time to web surf and discuss social justice and scold the politically incorrect and the other things we of the left really like to do. And basically, we would be publicly rewarded just for being our wonderful selves, which doesn't seem like too much to ask. Now, if you're on the right, you kind of stroke your chin about it a bit more because it's very much against the Protestant work ethic. Like, why are we giving or rewarding people for doing nothing? I mean, isn't this degrading and against our ideology? But wait a minute. What if you just pay off the taker class, who are 47% of everybody anyway, and restrict the actual means of production to a tiny elite, meaning us? I mean, you put them on salary and you don't pay them, but you don't give them any capital. You just take over the means of production yourself. Now, if 1% of the population has all the capital and makes all the important decisions about industrial deployment, well, it's an oligarchy, but as long as it's our oligarchy, why not go with that? I mean, why not just pay everybody else to sniff roses all day? They can stay in the kitchen, they can go to the church, they can raise the kids. And we, the guys who own the algorithms, we will become a patriarchal aristocracy. Because we know better anyway. And with big data, we can even prove that we know better. So this is a potential new social contract. There's actually an area of agreement here, and I think people are like sniffing that. And it feels like a little bit of daylight and, you know, a very dark civil Cold War. But if it happens, and let's assume that it does, in my opinion, I think it's going to be a lot more like previous historical arrangements than we suspect. I don't think it's going to be a genuinely novel situation. I think it has historical parallels. And I can imagine quite a wide variety of potential universal basic income regimes. I mean, just ways we would rearrange society if we didn't have capitalism, wage slavery, the work ethic, consumerism, the kind of life that we grew up among. Ways that are quite different from the way we live today, but not so entirely different from other human arrangements that genuine human societies have had. Possible futures for radical automation. So I'll start with the worst ones first, like the really bad possibilities. I think that's almost always the best place to start. I mean, don't end with the worst part and the kind of the downside. You should begin with it. Because instead of, you know, claiming, well, you know, we've got this like exciting idea in social innovation and we think might be great, but let's admit it, there might be some trouble. You should go with the caveats first. Because that way, when you approach the upside later, you'll feel a psychic relief. You've actually confronted the hardest and thorniest and most difficult part when you had some intellectual energy. That's like going to gym first thing in the morning. I mean, it's painful, but it's the worst thing that will happen to you all day. The rest of the day is a piece of cake compared to that. So, you know, eat the cold frog first. So, historically speaking, what happens to large groups of people who can't find work? I mean, they can't be integrated into an economic system. They don't provide economic benefits. They don't expand the general wealth. I mean, what happens to them, generally speaking? Okay, number one, the Native American situation. Okay, so here's some people, and they're like here first, and they're minding their own business, but they don't have any flags or any money and no conventional education, and they completely lack a private property system. And also, they're fooling around on some potentially valuable real estate. What happens to them? Well, disease, military conquest, and reservations. That's what happened. That's what built the nation that we're standing in right now. That's America's heritage. Took a couple of centuries. It was not super fast to chase off the original population of North America. Nowadays, we'd use drones. Obviously, we'd speed up that process considerably. The people under the drones, okay, we regard them as backward. We know they're never going to collaborate. They exist in flyover land. Basically, they've got to go by whatever means necessary. Okay, a bad possibility. However, it happened historically. It's not a made-up idea. It's plausible. Very human. Okay, version number two, prison systems and labor camps. Nazis and Soviets. Okay, people nowadays, they talk about fascists and Stalinists, but they don't understand fascist and Stalinist activities as an engineering solution, like a solution for national socialism. You know, a genocidal system is not about killing people just to be mean and bad. You don't do it to be the villain. It's about methodically liquidating economic classes of people. It's about Lebensraum. It's about getting rid of populations because they're in the way of the more productive populations. And it's not even entirely racial. For instance, under Nazism, the mentally retarded can be your own children. But they've also got to go for the sake of the increased efficiency. Now, I know that mentioning Nazi death camps feels unspeakable and gets very Godwin's law. But that's not any kind of remote, theoretical sci-fi kind of prospect. That happened on, you know, and it went on for decades. I mean, it was Europe and the Soviet Union, and the Soviets eliminated social classes of people. Liquidate the kulaks. You know, why? Because the kulaks own farms and they're interfering with collective farm solutions. There's an economic rationalization behind it. Okay, episode number three. We're getting a little lighter here. Refugee camps. Okay, they're displaced people. They don't have an economy anymore. thing blew up, fell over, you know, they're under embargo, whatever. 60 million of them in the world now, probably lots more off the books. It really is kind of like a post-scarcity economy, because you're in the camp and basically the UN Human Commission on Refugees brings you whatever you need to get by. And what is the least that you can get away with and kind of like survive, you know, manage? Okay, it's not universal basic income, it's universal basic everything. It's kind of like goods in kind. Physical goods, shelter, food, clothing, medical protection from epidemics, armed marauders, all of that stuff. How much? $1,200 per person. $1,200 a head per year, which even includes keeping the people in the camps from killing one another, because they're not happy to be in there. Okay, $1,200 is really a hard price to beat. You're talking universal basic income, just we could afford that. And it's really cheap. A lot cheaper than keeping people in prisons, probably even cheaper than killing them in some ways. That is the baseline guaranteed human expense. IKEA, very into designing this, doing awesome IKEA work for refugees. They're really good at it, and it's very real world in these UNHCR camps. You're in one, you got no job, you're in all kinds of abstract trouble, but the charity authorities just park you someplace, and you're looked after. $1,200. Okay, possibility number four, the armed forces. Right, you're not in a death camp, you're not in a labor camp, you're in a military camp, you're in a military base. People just draft the entire civilian population. Do you really want a guaranteed annual income? Here it is, and here's your uniform, and here's your barracks, and here are your orders. And that's the new social contract. Now, that would play with the right wing, because the right wing is patriotic. For them, the army is the people. Why not make the people the army? Do not pay people to sit around on the couch munching Cheetos. Tell them to make our country more powerful. One huge paramilitary civil defense corps. Everybody, the wives, the kids, grandpa, all the ethnic minorities, the cats, the dogs. Okay, they don't have jobs, but they do have ranks and serial numbers and national flags. Now, that's got the political advantage because an army, unlike these other UBI situations, is not at the mercy of the robot engineers. On the contrary, they've got the guns. They can turn off the robots. They can seize power. And this prospect from a UBI perspective sounds quite plausible to me. It's probably the most plausible, really. People in armies often spend a lot of time doing nothing much. I mean, you know, little make-work things. They're not productive industrial workers, but they are in shape, they're fit, they have meaning and ambition in their lives, and the right wing always loves the army. The army is authoritarian, it has a clear chain of command, it's a very solid, time-tested, rugged social structure. It's like the hardest one we have. Very hard to crush an army. Every nation has at least some military forces. There is no inherent limit to how big an army could become. The entire human race could become an army. We could be 11 billion people in a uniform. And if we don't need economics because the machines took over everything, why not mankind as a huge army? Okay, number five, retirement villages. I mentioned there because they're just everywhere. This is the existing example of people just hanging around with nothing to do because they're retired. They're on pensions and they get a universal pension income, sort of, so to speak. Okay, just take that and spread it around a little. Move it, you know. Everybody retires at 40, let's say. They play shuffleboard after that. It doesn't have to be invented, nothing sci-fi about it. Tons of retirement communities, going to be more and more. Population's getting older and older. Demographically, we're all heading there. We go there eventually. Why not just accelerate the process a little bit? Everybody just learns to mimic the elderly, just kind of like move the ratchet bar down. You start with like smart, elder-friendly urban design, you could call it that, and then just kind of take it from there, just kind of ease into it. And you'd end up with a UBI world. Number six, the academy. Okay, universities, everybody learns. Everybody's in school. Austin is a giant UT Austin. There's plenty of room in schools. People tend to stay pretty busy there, even if they're not visibly working and earning a wage. Schools have a governance structure built in. There's departments, chairs, boards. People can get tenure. Guests can be in residence at the school. People do research in academies. They publish, but they don't get paid by the word. They're not on salary. They're not wage workers. So you can imagine a school of people who all have guaranteed income that grows to just vast proportions. If you're studying something of interest, and we decide it's of interest, you get to stay in our school. If you don't study, you're a troublemaker, you're on scholastic probation, we flunk you, we throw you out of our school. The town is the university, Bauhaus, Black Mountain College, Cranbrook. These are like intentional designer communes. People just live there, eat there, they never leave. You can imagine Oxford, Cambridge, the Sorbonne, on the size and scale of New York City, Lagos, Tokyo. You know, the bones and the brains of academic society are already there. Universities are 900 years old. We understand very well how they work. They've got big crowds of people in them. They're not conventional economies, but they do a lot of stuff. So the issue would be reduced to a scaling problem. The robots work, and you know, and the deep learners are studying whatever they study, but human beings are at work in research and development. The kind of critical intellectuals, basically. Okay, possibility number 7. Mankind doesn't work. Take shelter in religion instead. Religion. All our cities and factories are reorganized as monasteries and nunneries. It's a religious revival among humans, and there's no competition there because robots are all atheists. It's something we could do that we can't be priced out of. So we might imagine a situation where you're paid, but you have to go to Mass every day. You have meaning, hierarchy, you work effectively, a lot of work in monasteries. You don't work for profit, but you labor for the greater glory of God. Most people are religious or have some kind of religious impulse. People could live under Sharia law with a universal basic income. They could pray 5-10 times a day. They could do good works, perform charity, the things that monks and nuns do, priests. Why not? I mean, is this any worse than the army scenario? I'm wondering. Maybe you could be religious and also an army. You could be all jihad all the time. Okay, possibility number 8, hospitals and spas. Healthcare uber alles. Everybody's in the business of looking after human flesh. That's the only business that there is. Everything else has been automated. But nursing, healthcare, and even beauty treatments, they kind of need more of a human touch because they're about touching humans. So those become the world's primary economic activities, or post-economic activities. People don't work in a capitalist economy, but they concentrate on their own physical and mental well-being. They're just the exclusion of everything else. They devote enormous time and attention to wellness. Like with the instrumented self idea, they just gather data about themselves all the time. Or they're into transhuman voluntary surgery. They're just doing elaborate things to themselves, or difficult life extension practices. You got all the time in the world just to like live. Okay, cyborg living might be very complicated, physically needy. You'd at least have the time to do it. So you don't work, but you would be very busy becoming post-human. So would you rather be rich and employed or be immortal? I mean, is that like a worthwhile trade-off? Medical economics is always full of paradoxes. How much would a rich guy spend on his health if he thought he was going to die? Wouldn't he spend his entire fortune, basically? I mean, doesn't money become meaningless at that point? Number 9, I see I'm misnumbering them here. That's going to be good. Number 9, intentional rural communes. We go back to the land. Industry's over for us. We're all going to live next to nature now. Okay, I have to mention that because hippies have been thinking that's a great idea ever since Henry David Thoreau. It's traditional. It's romantic. Never works. It sucks unless you're the Amish. Don't try it. The Amish are great, but they need protection from a host society. For people to become rural again and just kind of live under the trees, it sounds like an odd idea to an urbanized society like us. But I would point out that Karl Marx, when he wrote about the world after the downfall of capitalism, said that after capitalism, people would raise cattle and practice archery. That's what people would do after the dictatorship of the proletariat. It's like, I've got my goat and a couple of cows, and me and the pals would go out in the backyard and just pop off a few arrows. You know, it's something to discuss. But Mr. Marx, how long does that go on? Forever. It goes on forever. I mean, that's how humanity lives until the sun goes nova. Strange idea. Okay, number 10, I think this is number 10. Dropout urban bohemia. This also has to be mentioned. We don't work because, you know, we're hippies. But we do have some modest income. We're not destitute. We're just alternative people. We're like Christiania in Denmark. We're just like, got our autonomous areas and like the whole town's just like us. And, you know, we build furniture out of leftover packing crates, and it's all about bicycles and marijuana and Christiania, Denmark, if you've ever been there. It's just very loose and kind of, you know, post-industrial alternative. Okay, why doesn't everybody just become a beatnik? Right? I mean, why not go ahead and drop out? Just like, well, you know, it's great. Okay, well, it tends to be a phase that people get over. I mean, people like being beatniks for a while. You never see a city that's a 100% bohemia. I mean, most big cities have bohemian districts, but they're not self-supporting. The bohemian districts tend to be the arts and entertainment and sex tourism districts. And I would not mind that way of life myself. I've lived most of my life in urban areas of that description, and by choice, but, you know, I'm a novelist. But I'm ranking this pretty high on the positive scale. I mean, it's like getting better and better here, because this is the Austin solution. People who enjoy this way of life, those are the keep it weird contingent. They're people who really like to self-actualize. I mean, they rank that very high on what they want to do in life. So you're going to pay me to keep it weird? Well, let's just see how weird I can get. You know, it's kind of a fulfilling possibility, really. And a prospect puts a smile on your face. And number 10 or maybe 11, enlightenment, like sadhus, Hindu holy men, yogis, Zen guys. And I rank this very highly because it's been an aspiration for many centuries for large amounts of the population. People don't work. They just roam the earth. They become spiritual mendicants. They're global nomads. They seek experience. They seek wisdom. They're on permanent vacation from economics. They might be in cruise ships or in gypsy caravans, or maybe they're just solo mendicants kind of walking around with a begging bowl and a staff, and you go to the ATM and your UBI pours out and you kind of wander off diagonally, and you're in the rave circuit, you're kind of permanent Burning Man here, and it is a profoundly post-economic, post-national, post-business, post-family. It's a state of generalized spiritual liberation, the Buddhist liberation from desire. Just one with experience. You walk the earth. Okay, an attractive way of life, really. I mean, many people do it. It has deep roots. It's a problem for the younger generation. You don't see any little kids sadhus. You can't raise a new generation when you're in this, you know, detached state. I mean, parenthood doesn't work under those circumstances. And also, although people are supposed to love being on vacation, realistically speaking, vacation's very stressful. I mean, people come back from vacation, their nerves are rattled and shot. They don't really like the spiritual adventure, you know, the kind of endless skydiving or whatever, thrill-seeking, the novelty. People don't like, they like that for about 2 weeks. After that, they want like a bath and a back rub. The things we hope for are not necessarily the things that are actually good for us. But it's new. I mean, it would be an interesting spiritual development, really, and one that I take seriously, because it reminds me of the Zen proverb, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. which is, you know, a very Zen thing to say, and it sounds kind of timeless and deep. But we're in a situation where the robots chop the wood and carry the water. You know, it's like the sound of no hand clapping. I mean, there's no water to be carried. I mean, it's really kind of a problem worthy of Zen consideration, in my opinion. It's like, what then? So, those are some possibilities. You know, they don't sound very glamorous. I mean, they're not kind of chrome-plated and rocket-scented. And that's why I think they're plausible. They actually sound human because they're things that human beings have historically done. Now, it might be that a UBI society of the future would not be like that at all. It would have no historical parallels. It would be completely novel, just like weird, like a radical inflection point, just like shattering the historical record. It's completely bizarre. A social singularity where the entire human race starts over from the utopian year zero, the human condition, totally revolutionized, smashed to bits, atoms. But, you know, I've heard stuff like that at South By for just decades. I mean, people here always talk like that. It's actually an old-fashioned way to talk. I mean, y'all are amazing, but not that level of amazing. I mean, not even. But you're actually very human. And, you know, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, the dominant industries of your tech conference world, are not utopias. They're not dystopias. They got a few spare rocket ships in the backyard. You know, they're interesting and different. They're not ultra-radically interesting and different. They're software-based platforms with broadband and not traditional analog industrial conglomerates. But they're very like their spiritual ancestors, America Telephone and Telegraph, Ford Motor Company, Sears Roebuck, the railways, the aviation business. They're quite like that. Really. Now, I can admit to the possibility of some near-future post-work world that's really, truly, severely different from our own and from all other previous ways of life. And I quite enjoy thinking and writing about that. It really tempts me. And you know, I was like, an exciting thing to put on the page. Like, you know, you gather more readers that way. It has this kind of, you know, freshness. But although that's good science fiction, it kind of expands the limits of what we can think, I also think it's sloppy politics. And it's bad social policy. It's mental laziness. And also, running things or claiming the ability to run things because you assume the sense of wonder. It's like, I'm going to do it because it's just so insanely great. Okay, that's extremely undemocratic. It's willfully cruel to people who don't get a look in. It's quite authoritarian. And the people who don't get any advice and consent about the technological sublime that you're very keen on, they might believe you for a while, maybe a decade, two, but three, four, five, they will resent you eventually. They will react with spite. Now, I totally get it about the sublime, because I'm a literary artist. The beautiful and the sublime, wow, you know. But the sublime has a short shelf life. Atomic power was sublime. Space travel was sublime. And, you know, the information revolution was also sublime. And our age is a successor of the atomic age and the space age. And we have a lot of their habits. And we also have our Chernobyls and our abandoned moonshots that just don't work out. None of those things freed us from the burdens of our human condition. Those are not permanent burdens. We might be post-human someday. That would not surprise me. I actually think that's quite plausible. Then we'll have the burdens of a post-human condition. It's still a burdensome condition. It's just not human. Now, I like fiction, and I know that without vision, the people perish. I understand that people want myth. They want stories. They want reassurance. They want aspiration to higher things. They want to feel good about themselves, and maybe even especially when they're not being particularly good. People are haunted by guilt. People hunger for absolution. Okay, robots, deep learners, AIs, they don't do that. It's all about us. And that's where historical context is of great use and critical thought. If we went back 100 years ago, 200, 400, And we talked to the most intelligent and cultured people of those epochs, people who could understand our predicament. And we said, look, we've got a problem here. We've got advanced means of production that are about to make people irrelevant. I mean, we're really worried about it. We're so inventive that we've got no use for ourselves. We're making ourselves obsolete. We're becoming unnecessary. Okay, if you presented them with that problem, would they congratulate us? I mean, they might think it's great that we have relieved the ancient curse of toil, which the Bible says was given to us in our expulsion from the Garden of Eden. I mean, people in the past tend to think scripturally. They were very keen on that. But if our ancestors were to look us in the eye, they'd see in 1 minute that we're not Garden of Eden types. I mean, not even. On the contrary, we're so remote from the Garden of Eden, we will melt both polar ice caps for the sake of some cheap gasoline. All they would have to do is smell us to know that we're pulling a stunt here. We're not being honest about the situation. We're drinking our own bathwater with this problem. I think they would probably scold us for our misplaced priorities. They would say, okay, you're human like us. You want wealth, you want power, you want fame, sure, so did we. But why are you forfeiting all those things to robots and AIs? I mean, why did they become the protagonists of the human story suddenly? I mean, those aren't beings like us. Those are recipes. They're algorithms. They're embedded in networks of electricity. They're not historical participants. They could play a great game of Go. They're very capable. But when they win the game of Go, they don't take any joy at it. They don't even know they have won. They don't perceive the beauty of the game they have won. They're not alive. They have no will to live. And your problem is not that you invent them, but that secretly you envy them. That's your actual sin. You imagine that the AIs are better participants in history than you are. They make better decisions than you. They're better informed than you. They're more efficient than you. They know more and they work more cheaply. What you're really doing is imitating their lack of character. Machines have no joie de vivre. They lack purpose. They have no ambition. If humanity declared itself useless and we all vanished, our machines would stop. They would never build some kind of computational utopia and conquer the galaxy. That is pure psychological projection on our part. It's pure myth. Computers are complicated. They're not simple shovels and crowbars. But they're of a way different order than simple hand tools. But conquering the universe, that is not in the cards for them. They have no appetite. If they were alone in the universe, they would shut themselves off. And that would not be suicide, because they're not alive. It would be the proper decision for them. It would be efficient. Why go to the trouble of computing when you can gain nothing by doing it? AIs have no identity. There's no you there to satisfy. They're only puppet faces that we put on them so that we can think about them in a comfortable, mythical way. AIs can't kill themselves. They can't commit suicide. They can't despair of existence. They can shut down to save power. However, we can commit suicide. We can despair of life. And when we say that our machines can render us irrelevant, we are buying into a suicidal ideology. It has the dark allure of a martyr operation. If we have no purpose and we think of ourselves as the surplus flesh, we're going to reach for the OxyContin bottle. We're going to float out on a paisley tide of pills. A lot of people are doing that nowadays. Now, we modern people of this decade, we're not aggressive as historical societies go. We're remarkably peaceful and tolerant. But this particular breed of lethal passive despair is one of our period's major moral vices. It's bad. We don't lack gusto because our life is inherently not worth living. We actually lack conviction and self-esteem because we're lying to ourselves. We're dying the way people die under a voodoo curse, baffled and wasting away. Now, our ancestors suffered more than we do, but they kept at it because otherwise we wouldn't be here. And we are here, and we're also now, and we can profit by locating ourselves within history. We can ask for the judgment of history. We can say, go ahead, scold us, you know, hit us. We know we don't deserve praise. Well, history would reply, you are forfeiting your position as responsible beings. That is your sin. The flaw in your civilization has a name. It is moral cowardice. You are using the turbulence of technical disruption as your excuse to ignore the basic interests of the coming generations. You're using it to make it all about you. And despite your so-called information technologies, you are beset with propaganda, lies, witch hunts, and cult delusions. You are using your tremendous powers to make yourselves helpless. So instead of pretending that you can become an archangel on the head of a silicon pin, you need to recover your existential authenticity. Instead of gazing around yourself in shocked amazement and pretending, oh, this is not who we are, you need some sincerity, some frankness, and the honest humility and contrition to say, actually, yeah, this is who we are. We're acting like blacked-out drunks. We're like clowns. And although the humor of our predicament should never be overlooked, this moment, too, will pass. If we don't pass out for good, we will wake up sober some morning. We're going to stagger to our collective bathroom mirror, and boy, will we be a sight to see. And since we will be sober someday, well, we might as well try to become sober now. I mean, why not get ahead of the curve there? I will point out that sobriety is a mental quality no AI can have. It's beyond them. Now, right now, being sober is a rather lonely take on things. It's like being the only guy who's not drunk during Mardi Gras. But Mardi Gras, when you're not wasted, it's actually quite interesting. You should try it. It's more edifying than the double vision when you're collapsing on the lamppost. You really see Mardi Gras when you're sober. You don't get to lose yourself in the general ecstatic moment, which is a loss, seriously. But you're also the pioneer of a situation that everybody will be in later when they wake up, hungover. Only you won't have the regrets or the headache. So, with that said, I'm going to go write a book. And I'll be back in a year to see how you've been doing. Thanks for the attention and good luck.